Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
Hey, hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. It's Tuesday, and we're in March 2024. I'm doing a remote call with a mezcal importer and pioneer out of Mexico, and it's going to be a really great show today. Big shout out to Heritage Radio Network. It's our 15th anniversary coming up, and keep up with Heritage Radio Network.org. All right, so I'm Jimmy Carboni. I'm the host on Beer Sessions Radio, and my guest tonight is?
I am Reed Spear with Origin Imports Incorporated.
Well, Reed, I met you a few years ago at one of the first Bolozol events in New York, and I know you've come out to Denver as well. I'm finding my little personal journey, you know, looking at the world of mezcal, pozole, and agave spirits is one of the most interesting things that I feel like is going on in the food and beverage scene right now. So I thought we'd do a deep dive with you just because, you know, whenever you're at the events, I always like your stuff more than most others. In fact, right now I have a bottle that you gave me a couple years ago, Cuento Cuentos, and it says it's made in Oaxaca. And everything is very personalized. It's Maximiliano Serafin Garcia Geronimo. There's a kind of a mystery to this with so many growers and makers and the quality levels, and you call yourselves Real Mezcal. Tell us a little bit, before we talk about your backstory, let's just talk about what Real Mezcal is and a little bit about what you're doing at Origin.
Sure. And I just want to say, I appreciate you having me on this show. It's good to talk to you. You're a bit of a legend in the industry. It's really good to be, I got like 600 shows or something up right now. Quite impressive.
Oh, thanks, man.
Yeah, of course. And you're right. We don't get enough time to talk at the shows because, well, we're all doing our thing. And I love the Bolozol program, but it seems like no sooner you get set up, you get slammed with people interested in exactly the questions you're asking. With this project, I've got three brands just to help orient your listeners. I've got Cuento Cuentos, Mezcal, and beneath that I have El Barro, which is a kind of a De La Casa Mezcal. It's designed for mixing. And then I am half owner of the Tzok Rum with my friend Carlos Mendez in Oaxaca. And with Real Mezcal, the idea was, you know, getting into this, how do I alter the product and the tradition of mezcal the least? You know, it's one of those things where, you know, any involvement at all in a 400-year-old tradition in an effort to commercialize the product is going to end up having some influence, whether you like it or not, right? And so the idea in my mind and the driving force behind the project is, how do I stand out of the, you know, get out of the way of the tradition and just present the product as faithfully and as authentically as I can to the consumer? And so that's why we have, you know, a rather extensive label where we are detailing the entire production process, why we let the mezcal families do their make their mezcal and then present it as it comes to us. So you'll notice that we're not proofing to a certain proof. We just get the Physica Chimica test back from the lab, and then we handwrite the ABV on the bottle along with you know, the lot number and the date, and anytime there's a change in process, we have to update the label too. So that's sort of the idea, is get out of the way and present authentic small batch mezcals to mezcal enthusiasts.
Well, I'll tell you, Reed, I'm looking at your label, just, and this one, it says mezcal artisanal 100% agave. And as it goes down, there's a lot of different categories, and I'm not sure what they are. Finca, cosecha, tierra, pueblo, elevation. Sounds like this is the terroir or the origins.
Yes, we give pretty much the entire, quite the cuentos means storyteller. And so we give the entire story of the production of each batch on the label. And we've gotten away from calling them mezcals. We have our own nom, so we can call them mezcal. We can put the hologram on the label if we want. But since just before the infamous CRM debacle in spring of 21, we stopped with the certification. We still do the safety testing, of course, but we just call them destilados de agave. We found that the categories were too constraining for what we were finding in the field, and we also found that the certification apparatus was slowing down the delivery of the product to the U.S. So we just set that to the side now. Call everything destilado de agave. And so, but there on the label, you have everything from where the agave was grown. It takes you through the entire process. So how it was harvested, we know where it was grown, where it was distilled, what kind of wood, or even if it's not wood, what kind of tina it was fermented in, what kind of wood it was roasted over, for how long, the distillation, you know, the days of fermentation, everything, it's all in there. So it's as much detail as we can reasonably provide given the space on a bottle.
Yeah, it's kind of like everything you really want from a fine product, you know? I mean, it's like you want to know who's growing it and how and all these details.
I think that transparency matters a lot to people who buy mezcal. They understand. The average consumer doesn't, but an aficionado understands, you know, you're dealing with a group of people who are not the most well off in the world, and they deserve recognition and not to be hidden in the background. So we like to put them in front and center on the bottle and bring them the following that they deserve. I mean, you know, you've had a handful of Max's mezcals, you start to understand that he's got this hard to describe other than to say a soft touch, and the mezcals that he's producing they're just elegant. You know, what would be the point in just hiding everything behind a brand name and not, you know? So we've got a number of families we work with, and they all have different styles and techniques and family traditions. And, you know, you can set a consumer expectation based on the producer. And so we really like being able to, you know, put the producer front and center. And of course, you know, at this stage in the game, May will be our 9th anniversary. These are all friends, you know, those are great people that we love and hang out with. So
it's pretty great. So this is the name of the makers on here: Maximiliano Serafino Garcia Hieronimo. That's pretty great.
Where he lives, and anyone who wants to go find him can go seek him out.
Wow. So, like, back to your story. So, I know you took this really seriously, and said your background is you're detail oriented. So, tell us about your mezcal journey, your journey to Oaxaca.
I was coming out of the dietary supplements in 2004, dietary supplements industry, and I sold a company and I started to travel. And on my places of, I wanted to see after, you know, when I had a little bit of money and a break and professionally, and I could travel, Oaxaca was high on the list because at the time, and I still do, I had a real abiding interest in ethnobotany. And anyone who studied ethnobotany knows that Oaxaca is this kind of a world center for medicinal plants and traditional medicines. And so I was just fascinated by that topic. And every book that I ever read on ethnobotany, which at the time was all of the books, mentioned Oaxaca in one capacity or another. So I went there in 2006 and had my first really great mezcal at the Mezcaleria. Is still there. It's La Mezcalerita. It's right on the Avenida Calzada, just up from the Santo Domingo. And they've grown tremendously since then. You know, it was a tiny, maybe 10 by 20 place in 2006. But now they've got, you know, they've expanded into the back. They've got a rooftop. They're serving food. And that's how I found mezcal, or mezcal found me, I guess, is the way we like to say it in the industry, 2006. And so when I was looking for something new to do in 2012, that was high on my list. I grabbed a bottle from that Mezcalerita and went down to Chiapas, San Cristobal de las Casas, a couple of days later, and stayed up with my then girlfriend, and we just drank the whole bottle and really felt none the worse for wear the morning after. And I think a lot of people who've had, who've overconsumed agave spirits are shocked the next day that they don't have a splitting headache. And, that was another one of the things that sort of stuck out in my memory. And so I reached out to the Denver consulate, the Mexican consulate in Denver. They put me in touch with Pro Mexico Houston, and Pro Mexico Houston put me in touch with Pro Mexico Oaxaca, and I started meeting people, and they started giving me airfare to come down. And what happened was, on the third trip down, the director of Pro Mexico Oaxaca was curious why I hadn't selected some labels to import. And I told her, her name's Thalia, Thalia Frigo Reyes, wonderful human being, and she and her friend, Elizabeth Santiago, were running the office there. They asked me why I hadn't selected any labels to import yet. And I said, look, you're just throwing these great events and putting finished products in front of me. I really want to go deeper. I want to find the people who don't know that you're having these events, the people who've got, a long, long family history in this and really no wherewithal to get the market. I want to make myself useful. And so they introduced me to Carlos Mendez Blas, who, over the following 3 years, he and I became great friends, learned a lot about mezcal. He had just lost his father who died at a young age. And so he pivoted from being a pilot to the family mezcal business. And he and I kind of learned mezcal together. And we, just out beating the bushes for 3 years, really, and me, including me, learning Spanish along the way. So that's sort of the potted version of the story.
How about a quick study for our listeners and what good mezcal is? There's something about either finishing and clay. There's different styles like Espadin, which you seem to champion when it's good.
So quick crash course for people who don't know much about mezcal or really understand the category. Everybody's familiar with tequila. Tequila is a subtype of mezcal. And mezcal is any liquor that that is made from an agave. And so there's something like 211 species of agave in the world, and I think approximately 85-90 of them are endemic to Mexico, and the vast majority of those in Oaxaca. So any liquor made from agave is a mezcal. Tequila is actually a mezcal. It's a subtype. And so the average person has only been exposed to the Blue Weber agave in tequila, and probably unless they're drinking exceptional tequila, they've probably been drinking diffuser-produced tequila, which A diffuser is a machine that reverses the production process and speeds it up. So rather than roasting agaves over fire or steaming them, a diffuser first shreds it, then exposes it to heat and sulfuric acid in order to convert the inulin into a digestible sugar for the yeasts to produce alcohol from. Whereas the traditional production is to first roast and then grind and then ferment, and generally with wild yeast, not cultivated yeast. So the net result of that is that the average person who's had tequila, while they've had some type of mezcal, have had a very stripped down and you know, essentially flavorless or low flavor mezcal. You know, the best tequilas are great, but most people aren't drinking the best tequilas. I mean, I can think of probably half a dozen tequilas that are still being made in the traditional manner, whereas, you know, there's thousands of brands of tequila. Just to give you an idea, I mean, if you went out to pull a bottle of tequila off the shelf, it just, odds are it would be diffuser produced and it wouldn't be very good. With mezcal, I think the opposite's the true. You have the vast majority of mezcal brands, you know, still producing mezcal in the traditional manner. And I think the reason for that is because the market has turned away from industrial production and towards what I call the whole foodsization of products, where the consumer wants to know the producer. They want something that's local if possible. They want to meet the hand of the maker and see the small batch and know the story of production. And so, you know, big tequila has that as a headwind now. Mezcal doesn't. It's always been artisanally made. And I say that in a generic sense, not in the category, sense of the category. So let's talk about the categories for a second. Under the denomination of origin for mezcal, there's a handful of categories, and this has to do with production / aging methodology. And the first is just mezcal. So that's industrial produced. This is some of the products that maybe when we were teenagers we had that was yellow, had some worms in the bottle, and was generally pretty awful stuff. And then you have artisanal mezcal, which is getting closer to the roots of how it was made over the last 400 years. The distinction here is that with artisanal mezcal, the use of copper stills is permitted. So the ancestral category uses clay pots. And as you can imagine, heating and cooling clay at the wrong pace or at the wrong moisture level leads to breakage. And so it didn't take long for mezcal families to pivot away from clay and into copper just to save the hassle of dealing with breakage, but also because the copper still generally holds around 280 liters, whereas the clay still holds 60, 80, or 100 liters, depending on how large that pot has been made. There are pockets of producers who are still using clay vessels, and that's a point of pride for them. And we work with a couple of those families. So that's some pretty rare stuff. And then you've got other categories that have to do with aging. So you've got now mezcal, we've talked about, artisanal with copper, ancestral with clay. And then the other categories have to do with aging and flavorance. With aging, you can have a reposado, which is Spanish word for rested. And so this is, 12 months or less. Then you have añejo, which is over the 12-month period. So that's the year. And they have aged in vidrio, which means in glass. And that's a fascinating category we can come back to. And then there is another category called avocado con, meaning flavored with, where you're permitted to add flavorants after the product has been distilled. And mezcal, this tends to be, you know, something like a spice or a fruit juice or coffee or mole or something like that. And then there's another category called pechuga. And the pechuga, which is Spanish word for breast, is a a category that includes a third distillation. And these have traditionally been made in preparation for and use during a celebration. So maybe a wedding or a christening or a quinceañera or something along those lines. And in that process, the mezcal, which is almost all two distillation. So first pass. So you created the alcohol with fermentation. The first pass concentrates the alcohol up to about 25 to 30% ABV. And that's called shishe or ordinario. And then the second pass concentrates to about 50 to 60% ABV. And that's what we call mezcal. So a third distillation is then done on the mezcal, in which a flavoring agent, traditionally a chicken breast or a turkey breast, hence the word pechuga, is suspended from the montera, which is the condenser in the still. And so the alcohol vapors condense on the meat and then drip down into the final product. People have been experimenting with these for decades, if not centuries. And, there's all kinds of different versions of this that are available. The great mezcal brand Vago has a beautiful one called Elote, where they have a suspended toasted corn. Del Maguey famously did one with an Iberico ham. And you see all kinds of different creative things in the pechuga category. So those are lots of fun. And that's basically the categories in a nutshell. And I hope all that made sense. And if you've got questions, please ask them. I'll make it.
No, that's really helpful. And I know whenever we do the bowl tasting, the different reps will whisper to each other, "Oh, we've got this one pechuga." And I appreciate that you explained that to me more, because I knew there was a chicken involved.
And not always. And I asked a producer once, who came up with this idea. And the joke is some mescalero's wife asked him to cook dinner.
So he steamed it at the same time. Pretty much.
Yeah, I know. I mean, when these things come out of the still, they're nothing you'd want to eat. But they impart an umami to the mezcal, and in sort of an unctuousness that completely changed the character of the mezcal. And they're fascinating. And, Max, for example, when I first met him, he had some left over from whatever fiesta he had made it for. And he had distilled this with grapes as his third distillation. So he just suspended a couple bundles of grapes under the Montera, and it was a Tobola grape pechuga, and it just had enough of this grape flavor to just make it sparkle, and it was really outstanding stuff. And that's the kind of thing that the mezcal aficionado loves to try. It's an infinite variety in them, and they're always a surprise, and they're always, appreciated at some level. Whether you like it or not, you can say, "Wow, that's at least fascinating."
Oh yeah, no. Whenever I see you at the events, I mean, sometimes you're there by yourself, sometimes you're there with Christopher Craft Distillers. I always want to try what you have. How many different, in the course of a year, how many different bottles of different products are you importing into the States?
Oh man, I don't know. We last year was tough, I think, for everybody. So we pared it down a little bit, but there are years where we'll do 12 to 15 different expressions. So that's a term I should explain to your listeners. When we talk about mezcal, we talk about expressions, and an expression is the combination of the person who made it plus the type of agave. So you're drinking, I don't know what agave you have in front of you. Maybe you have an Espadin by Max, Serafine Geronimo Garcia. And so that's the expression. But we'll import anywhere from 12 to 15 expressions a year. And we have what we call the legacy line. So these are expressions that we always have in stock because we love them so much. And then we do lots of guest expressions, where these are one-off things that we've found just tooling around the countryside in Mexico, or someone's brought to our attention, or a mezcalero was just fooling around with. I'll roll up on a palenque and someone will say, "Hey, check this out. We did something that we haven't done before," and I'll taste it and I'll say, "Well, that's absolutely amazing. And how many liters do you have?" And it's, you know, less than 100, something like that. But it's fun to do, and it keeps the aficionados interested, and I love it. I mean, to me, that's what's great about the category is that continual fountain of novelty coming out of these producers. They're so creative.
So if there's 100 liters, will you import that to the States? How many bottles would that be?
You just divide by 0.75, so it's 133 bottles. And, you know, there's a little bit of loss in the bottling process. And we like to throw a few bottles in our mezcal library so that we have a record of everything that we've sold. And so maybe 120 bottles make it to the States. And, you know, Chris is the importer. He can go out to his buyers and say, "Look, there's 120 bottles of this. It's unique in the world." And they'll say, "Yeah, put me down for a case or two of that." And those things go fast and they're fun to do. So, yeah, we like to do those.
Yeah, the bottle I have, Maximiliano Serafin Garcia Geronimo from Puentes, is this is number 152 out of 319. So that's pretty neat, man.
Do you have a Zespedin or a Squish?
Actually, I don't even know where I can read that.
Should be right below his name. That's a really old Quiche. Bottle.
There's
a
Quiche.
There you go.
Yeah. Quiche. Well, what's Quiche versus Espadine?
It's a different species of agave. So, you know, you'll find there's a handful of agaves that you see most often because they're farmed, they're most readily available, and those would include, and I'll give you scientific names and common names. So that is an agave Karwinski, and it has a lot of common names, Quiche, Quiche, Madre Quiche, Barril, Cereal, Tobasiche, Marteño, and those common names vary depending on the region that you're in geographically. The locals have different common names for the same species or variations on the species. And the way that I explain this to people is that if you wanted to have a Syrah, but you were in Sydney, Australia, you'd ask for a Shiraz. And so you have, so agave Karwinski is commonly found, agave angustifolia, probably the most common, that's an Espadin. And then you have Marmorata, which is Tempestate, Podatorum, which is a Tobala. We also, I think we have one of, maybe the only one that I'm aware of that's continually imported is a Tobala, that's Agave Simaniana. And then see some other common ones. Cupriata. Cupriata is pretty common out of Guerrero usually. Anyway, go ahead.
No, it's great. I mean, you're really going deep with me, and it's part of deciphering the label that's interesting. Talking about wine, I'll talk about beef. I first got introduced to what real transparency was years ago with a New York State beef farmer, and he was talking about what he wishes people asked for on the label, and he was talking about the same kind of thing. It's, you know, what breed a cow, what elevation they were raised at, what they were eating, and a whole bunch of other things. And I used to think he was crazy. but now I get it.
Yeah, I don't think so. Consumers are, they're, you know, I've been dealing with some form of, you know, customers since 1997, and they're smart and they rightfully want to know where their things that they're ingesting are coming from. And I think the more information you give them, the better the brand looks to them. You, you want to build that trust between the brand and the consumer, and that's how you do it. Transparency.
You know, it's true. It's almost like cheese. I think cheese, thinking about having had artisanal cheeses, American farmstead cheeses, the same kind of thing. What, you know, what time of year where they melt, and it ties in with what they're eating, and you know what the grass is like, and you can definitely, you know, real artisanal cheeses, you know the batch,
yeah,
and, it really comes out. So that's a great intro. You know, one thing that when we talk about, you know, your backgrounds in nutritional supplements, and you know, I as in the industry, you can't say that alcohol has health benefits, but as a drinker, I know one thing I love about Bolzol and all these great agave spirits that are there is that I taste a lot of spirits at the event, and the next day I don't feel any of the negative effects of the bad alcohol. You know, last night I had a beer somewhere, and it was a craft IPA. But honestly, today I feel like a wreck, and I know I'm like, what was in that beer that I didn't know about? You know,
right?
So, what is natural? You said natural and traditional production. What is it? You know, you're not a doctor, but what is it that makes certain good spirits just make you feel so good when others don't?
I think it's the congeners that come along with the fermentation and end up in distillation. I think it's what they use to stop fermentation, you know, to rest that before it's bottled. I think there's lots, especially in tequila, unfortunately. And I do like, I mean, I rip on tequila all the time on social media, but I just think it's actually rather unfortunate that it's gone this direction. It's because this whole movement for additive free tequila, well, I mean, that's only a movement because they got crazy with the additives. And I don't think that stuff is doing anybody any health benefits. And, you know, who knows what that results in the next morning. So, you know, like one of my favorite polemicists was Christopher Hitchens, and he has got this great saying that cheap booze is a false economy. And I really believe that. I think that if you're spending on quality, you're going to feel better. You're not going to get a splitting headache from it. So I think it's a constellation of things that goes into the product, starting from, you know, the quality of the initial material, the sugar source, the fermentation, what was used to stop fermentation, the quality of the distillation, the congeners that come out of it, preservatives, flavorings, colorants, all that stuff. So, you know, with mezcal, you have got a product and a process that's over 400 years old and really is relatively unchanged, even for brands that do proofing. It's just, you know, it's been that way for a long time. It's been celebrated for a long time. And, you know, I think that's part of the reason why.
That's a great intro. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions and Drink. Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jim Carbone. I'm the host, and it's celebrating our 15th year with Heritage Radio Network. Check us out, support us, become a member, heritageradionetwork.org. So I'm talking with Reed Spear of Origin and Cuenta Cuentos and all these great artisanal brands from Mexico. Reed, where are you right now? I know you're in Mexico. Do you live down there too?
Yeah, I'm just south of Cancun right now. I'm in Puerto Morelos. And people always ask me next why there. This area of Mexico really knows very little about mezcal, but I think it has got great potential for mezcal. So I'm here launching the domestic market with my product. And I might add that has one of the best airports on planet Earth. So it's easy for me to come and go from here.
Wow. So how, you know, one thing I noticed when we do Volazol or you and your sales, seems like every market's a little different. What are markets that have like, are really open to the natural mezcals?
Yeah, it's
a general question, but I know you.
No, it's a good question. It's quite remarkable. If you go to Texas, you'll be greeted with open arms. People know what mezcal is. They love it. They're curious. They want more. You know, like I said, down here in the Riviera Maya area of Cancun, people have heard of mezcal, but they have had rather bad mezcals. And honestly, I spend more time talking about and explaining mezcal to Mexicans than I do to Americans. You know, I just think that with the leisure time that comes with being in an affluent society in the U.S. Comes the ability to become curious about things that are, let's face it, rather frivolous. And so the alcohol and, you know, what you're drinking is one of those things. You've just got more time. You've got more headspace to dedicate to it. But even within the United States, there are regions that are just so much better off. You know, I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and it's a control state, among other things. But, you know, maybe a handful of restaurants and bars there that have mezcal or even know what it is. And those are all new within the last 5 years. So, you know, put that in contrast to Texas or Florida, parts of California, Illinois, very sophisticated mezcal market. Pacific Northwest is learning about it. And there's just a tremendous variation geographically.
What about the Denver market?
Colorado is my best. And, you know, I lived there for 23 years before I moved to Mexico. So it was the place I launched into. And they also have a very high percentage of Latino population living there. So, and I think that's important because that means that there's a good infrastructure for Latin restaurants, Mexican restaurants in particular. And just like Italian wines were supported by the Italian restaurant infrastructure in the U.S., you're going to see the same thing happen with mezcal. You know, I like to think that the people who get into the restaurant business, they start small, but they don't want to stay small. They want to grow. It's just a natural progression of things. And as they grow, they start to offer more sophisticated things to their clients. And one of those things is going to eventually be a liquor license, and then, you know, margaritas, and then tequila and good tequila, and then, oh, mezcal, have you tried mezcal? Here's some good mezcals, you know. So that's the sort of the value proposition of mezcal, if you will. It's just that's where it's headed, I think.
Yeah, and you start with, I remember, might have been 12 years ago, my old restaurant bar in New York City, we started with Danny Menia's Peloton, and we first introduced mezcal as either a mezcal margarita or a mezcal Negroni, which seemed to be what was going on then.
Yeah, and New York's a sophisticated market now in a big way. Lots and lots of mezcal available there.
It's a good one. So what for consumers, you know, starting out, a mixer, you know, a cocktail versus neat. You know, back in 2016, I met Art Doran and Danny Menia, and first time we worked together, we collaborated on an event called it was Mezcal y Barbacoa, and we had six chefs that Danny curated, and between Danny and Arik, we had 20 different mezcal bottles, and we did a long table, everyone got a tasting class and walked through, and it was like an industry style tasting, but that's the day I was hooked, because that, you know, I like to drink fine spirits, I like to drink the neat, and once I do, I don't always go looking for a cocktail. So that's just how I came to it.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think especially with the higher end mezcals. The best description I've heard of a cocktail is an elegant profanity if you're going to be making it with a good mezcal. So, I mean, I'm not opposed to anybody making a cocktail with it, and I don't judge anyone for doing it. It's a tricky thing to do, though, honestly. You know, I've noticed that certain agaves just, they won't play nicely with a lot of different cocktails. You can use an espadine in a margarita in place of tequila. You couldn't do that with a Karwinski. It doesn't work well with acids. And, if you're going to mix a Karwinski, then it's got to be, you know, melons or mint or something that's a little bit less acid. I think for a lot of people, that is the entrance point into mezcal is, I've had a smoky margarita, or I've had a mezcal Negroni, or some other talented bartender put together and made work. But it's, for me, it was sipping neat.
Yeah. And that's why we're on the same page. I was thinking the same thing, that even some of my favorite cocktails, you know, it's they're usually talking about the bitter that's in it, or now it seems like chartreuse is the new go-to specialty cocktail ingredient. And those drinks can taste great. But if I'm thinking that my spirit is the core of this drink, I'm not really getting the spirit.
Yeah, I hear you. When I think that with mezcal, you do get a lot of the spirit forward cocktails, and I do think bitters play nice with them. And I think, but a lot of the reason I think the cocktails aren't in the U.S., and this is why we invented the El Barro product, is that the stuff that's getting mixed, it's inexpensive and it's low ABV. And, you know, like I said, that's why we put together the El Barro cocktail, not to plug my own product here, but we wanted something that was high ABV, so it's 46 ABV, and we wanted something that would not get lost in a cocktail. Because, you know, in Mexico, in Oaxaca in particular, the cocktail culture there is fantastic. Super creative, super inventive, very noticeable mezcals in the cocktails. And so I think there's an economic aspect at play in the U.S. too. You know, by the time you get a quality bottle up here, it's not something you want to mix because it's just, you spent too much on it, and not a big market for $20 and $30 cocktails in the U.S.
Yeah. So tell us about El Barro. So it's meant for a well mezcal, but you still get some clay going on. Where does the clay come in?
Yeah, that was a project that Carlos and I discussed over our 3 years of tooling around, was how we were going to do like a De La Casa, because, you know, 2006 and up until, there's like a couple old school bars still in Oaxaca, but not a whole lot. But these bars all had like a De La Casa in this glass garrafón on the back bar with a little spigot, and you could order a beer and a shot, and it was serviceable mezcal. Some of it was really good, some of it was only okay, but you could have a beer and a shot. And we wanted to do something like that where, you know, it wasn't getting diluted along the way for cost purposes. And our solution was, you know, Carlos produces for a number of brands, white labels for a number of brands. And so I said, look, man, you've got all this copper shishe, which, if you remember from earlier in our conversation, is the first distillation. What happens if we grab some of that, finish it in clay when we want it to, you know, produce a hybrid between copper and clay, and that will be our well product. And so we did that, and it's fantastic. You get a little bit of the colloidal texture from the clay, and we got a high ABV, and we don't make any money on it really at all. We just wanted to get that product up into bars so that we could have good cocktails. People could have a good entrance point into mezcals, and just see what we could do about that whole cocktail culture problem as we saw it. So that's our solution.
Yeah, no, it's a really great intro to the subject. Let's jump to the story of your rum, because we're just hearing about Mexican corn whiskeys. First thing I'm hearing about Mexican rums.
Yeah, there's been a surge in interest in Mexican rums. I'm not the first mezcal brand owner to bring one in. But what happened was in 2019, just before the pandemic, on Labor Day in Mexico, which is celebrated differently, the employees have the day off, but they turn out to work, and then the boss brings a little fiesta, some food, some music, some beer and mezcal. And so Carlos and I went out to provide all this to his employees, and we started drinking some beers and eating some tacos and talking, and a bunch of these dudes were commuting down from the Sierra Mije, and they were, you know, Mije people. And it came out that they make rum up there, and, you know, about 4 or 5 hour drive out of Oaxaca. So they were commuting to work for Carlos every weekend. And so I asked them to bring some rum with them on their next trip down, which they did, and it turned out to be excellent. So fast forward, the pandemic hit, and we reached out to the Mijes, and they had been selling it, as a lot of, I think, alcohol producers were, as a base for hand sanitizer. And so we, in order to persuade them to sell to us, we doubled the price that they were getting paid for hand sanitizer and started storing it. Well, during the pandemic, as a gift to Carlos on his birthday, one of his buddies, who's into whiskey, gifted him about a dozen or so barrels out of Merceau, France. These are new, medium toast head, out of the Burgundy region. And he filled a bunch of these up with some of the rums. So that's how our Reposado came about. And we're running a Solera system on that, which we can talk about. But much to our surprise, in December of last year, I got a text from my customs broker, and he sent me this link to the Vine Pairs top 50 spirits of 23. And here the rum had been named as one of their top 50 of 23.
Amazing.
Totally amazing and totally unexpected. And, you know, for a product no one's ever heard of, for it to show up there was incredible.
How do you pronounce it? Sook?
Sook.
Sook.
Yeah. Sook is, the Mije people have their own language, their own religion, and their understanding of the human organism is that it's comprised of a body, a soul, and a sook. And a sook is like an animal nahual or totem that follows them through their life. And so this is one of the ideas that we thought was really fascinating about this group of people.
So it's your spirit animal.
Yeah, exactly. That's the concept. And then we have the deer with the serpent tail, the venado with the serpiente tail is one of the twin gods. It's actually a goddess, protector of the forest. There's the story is that there's a god and a goddess who are twins, and she is the protector of the mountains, and she's a shapeshifter between a deer and a serpent. So that's on the logo.
I know you have a lot of stories. Let's get one more out of you. Another producer or origin story, one where you're driving or tasting, and when you met someone that you're still working with.
Well, the bottle that you have came at the end of a long run of Carlos and I looking for a Karwinski that we thought would be suitable for bottling. And on about the third day of looking, Carlos said, "Hey, I heard of this guy up here on this bend just outside of San Dionisio. Let's swing in and see what this guy has to offer." And so we thought it was really good stuff, but we thought also maybe we were just kidding ourselves because we were exhausted. So we went back two more times, and that's how we found Max. just kind of serendipitously. But, you know, mezcal is full of this stuff, you know, like the way we found the rum or the way we found Max. And there's this great saying that you don't find mezcal, mezcal finds you. And we found this to be true. You know, like there's another one, again, over the pandemic, my manager in Oaxaca, a business school student, now graduated, named Alan Lara. His sister's a school teacher, and she was working in the Mihuatlan region. And one of her students knew that her brother, my manager, was working with a mezcal company. And so he said to his school teacher, "Hey, my dad's a mezcalero." And so we got connected with Laurentino Santos in that manner. And he's doing a Mexicano, which is a macrocantha, agave macrocantha. And he just did an agave azul, which is agave tequilana.
Wait, go back. What is he doing?
I'm talking about the agaves he's using.
Okay.
Agave macrocantha, which is the common name Mexicano, and agave tequilana, which is the common name agave azul, which is the agave used for tequila.
Okay.
And they're fantastic. And just another one of these sort of happy accidents that occurs along the way.
And then what surprises you now? I mean, and I know you're down in Mexico, you're working on some markets there. I know your product's going to be at the Denver Bowl again. You know, yeah, does anything surprise you? It's, you know, things of agave spirits have really taken off a lot. Just in my short time in them.
The rum is a complete surprise to me. And I'll tell you what else is a surprise about that is how fanatical the rum enthusiasts are. I don't know what I was expecting, but those guys are, you know, the people who love rum, they're even more intense than the people like mezcal. I think they've got unbelievable collections and are just so into it. And there's rum festivals everywhere. And I'm excited about the next round of spirits to come out of Mexico. And I don't know what it's going to be. I mean, we have like a cucharilla, which is a sotol that's outside of the sotol designation in the hopper. And I'm excited about posh. I don't know if you know what that is.
No, I don't.
So this is, it's a liquor that's made in the Chiapas region. And it's often a combination of things. So it can be cane and agave. And there's no real regulation over what goes into it, but some of them are really fantastic. And out of, out of South America, there's cocuy. There's a lot of stuff happening in California now with agaves. In Africa, in Australia, people are growing agave. And so for me, you know, I'm just excited for the entire category. I think it's an amazing thing. And, you know, for people who care about the environment, agaves are a wonderful carbon sink too. So to see the number of agaves under cultivation increase over time is going to be beneficial for the environment as well. So nothing really surprises me, and everything surprises me, but it all excites me.
Well, that's a great way to end it. And the last thing, I see a lot of the mezcals that we know, there's beautiful pictures of harvesting the plants and that process. Again, for our listeners that don't really know it, including myself, what is the process? How long does it take an agave to grow typically? And then what do you do after you cut it?
Great. Yeah, thanks for asking. It's a habit of mine to think what everybody knows about mezcal. So the plants can take quite a long time to grow. A fast-growing plant in the agave world, it would be 7 to 10 years, and that would be your Espadin or your Cupriata. And that's the reason why you see so many of those agaves. And I kind of want to dwell on that for a second, because I think that Espadin, and especially Espadin, but also Cupriata, they kind of end up denigrated, because if you're new to mezcals, you're going to see a lot of them. And then you're going to become aware of other agaves, and you're going to think, oh, well, maybe agave, Espadin is just too common or whatever. But it's not the plant's fault that it grows fast. It's a great source for sugar. There's fantastic flavors coming out of it. A talented producer can do incredible things with Espadin. But so that's the fast-growing plant. And then some of them can take much, much longer. You have the Karwinskis will take 10 to 12 years. The wild Marmoratas will take 20 years to grow. Although in cultivation, and this surprised me and will surprise a lot of your listeners who know about mezcal, Marmorata, which is the Tempestate, under cultivation will mature in about 9 years. The Americanas can take a long time to mature, 15, 18 years. The Tobalas can take 10, 12 years. So that's a long time for a plant to grow. And, you know, once it sends up its reproductive flower called a quijote, that's it. It's done. It's over and done with. That plant dies. And so for that reason, that shoot is cut off. Let's say you've got a field full of plants and they're starting to get ready to reproduce. Well, you want to prevent that, because what happens in that situation is the plant's going to pour all of its stored energy, which is carbohydrate, and the sugar that you're going to need for fermentation goes into the reproductive effort. And so you have to shortcut that. And now we open up a whole bunch of questions about genetic diversity and how to prevent loss of genetic diversity. And so, this program out there that encourage people to let a bunch of these plants flower so they can be open pollinated. But anyway, the plant is harvested. So the spiky leaves, which are called pancas, are cut off, and they're cut close to the center of the plant. That center is called a piña. And, you know, on a big plant, these things can get pretty, pretty hefty. So we're talking, you know, hundreds of pounds, 200, 300, 400, sometimes 600 pounds for that piña. And so just imagine for a minute the labor it takes to harvest these out of a field. And then that stuff gets sold, or if you're lucky enough to own your own agave fields, harvested and carried to the palenque, where that piña is then divided up into, you know, let's say basketball-sized chunks. And then you have to convert that starch into a digestible sugar. So that's where the roasting comes into play. And so there's this massive horno or oven in the ground. It's just this conical hole in the ground. And in this pit, the mezcalera will build a big old fire and, you know, decide what wood they want to use and how much of it and how long they want it to burn for, to get the right temperature. So they get this nice big hot bed of coals, and every mezcalero has their own rule for when to start roasting. But then once that fire is at the right temperature, they cover that up with rock in order to prevent the searing or scorching of the agave. Pile those agave pieces in around it. Cover that agave with bagasse, which is the used fiber from a previous run. And then that gets covered with a tarp, and finally covered again with dirt in order to insulate it. And so in this oven, you have what's going to happen is the stuff that's really close to the coals is going to start to sweat and drip, and that's going to create a steam. And if you remember back to high school, steam energy is 8 times greater than that of boiling water. So there's a ton of potential energy in steam. And so that steam starts to cook the agave. And this is kind of like, again, something I think that people need to understand. They understand that sometimes they understand that tequila is steam cooked, but mezcal really is too. It's just that the steam is coming from coals, and so there's going to be some smoke included in the steam, but that creates a convection in that conical oven and underneath that tarp. And so in a few days, you have converted the inulin into digestible sugars. So the top comes off, those cooked agaves come back up out. And at this point, you know, it's delicious. It's edible food. It's delicious. It tastes kind of like a roasted apple or like apple pie. Really good tasting stuff. Some of it's slightly caramelized and some of it's further away from the fire is not caramelized. And so you have all this like interplay of different flavors. There's some, you know, some acid still left in. And then that gets macerated by either a horse-drawn wheel, stone wheel called a tahona, or it's done manually in a, looks like a canoe. It's called a canoa and a mallet. So a mazo and canoa arrangement where it just gets pounded by hand. And this is the, you know, the artisanal, the ancestral process again, where this is all done in the most arduous way possible with the highest risk for loss. And, you know, like the Cruz family that we work with, you know, we're talking about Don Calvo, who's now 87 years old, doing all this labor. And it takes days just to grind this stuff. And then it goes into the wooden vat, which for fermentation. And to that vat, you add water. And the vat is fairly well impregnated with not only yeast, but bacteria from previous distillations. And so, and then you've got all the aerial yeasts. And so you have the ambient yeast begins this fermentation process. And the fermentation process takes, you know, 5 to 7 days, depending on the temperature. Sometimes during the winter, it takes longer. Sometimes during the summer, it takes a little bit less time. And this is where the alcohol is created. Fermentation creates alcohol, distillation concentrates it, but also where a lot of the flavors come in. And so this, a good protocol, a good family institutional knowledge and series of procedures and processes that have been refined over literally generations comes into play. Because if you're doing things well, you're going to get a good fermentation and then you're going to get a good distillation because you're doing these things the right way, the way that you've been taught. And one of the best quotes talking to Angel Cruz Robles. This is a family now with 4 generations because his father is alive, his grandfather's alive, and his son's learning now. So they have 4 generations of mezcal makers in alive working in the same area. And the way he phrased it to me is he's got a degree in mathematics, really sharp guy. And he said, we are still learning what we learned when we didn't know we were learning it. So the idea is that they've got this institutional knowledge and they're still sort of unpacking the new scientific understanding of what it was they were doing when they were learning it. And it's a really fascinating craft in that regard because they've had this process sorted out for hundreds and hundreds of years. And only recently do we, you know, understand about fermentation, about distillation, about this whole process and why it is what they're doing actually works.
Oh man, this has been a great show. You know, once again, we're talking about time, attention to detail, patience, and hard work, and the importance of that product from the agriculture. You know, it's really wild. Last question. I know we're running out of time, but when you talk about the ambient yeast, is all that done in the country? I mean, would the yeast in the city be different than in the country?
Oh, yeah, no doubt about it. Look, I'll go back to the Cruz family once again. Senior Don Calvo has his palenque down in his crease next to a creek, whereas his grandson has his up on a sunny hillside. And you can taste them in the mezcals, which palenque, which mezcal came out of. You've got, you know, different humidity. It's going to support different yeasts, different bacteria. Makes a huge, huge difference. And, you know, this is one of these things where, you know, we don't really understand fully the entire process of fermentation. You know, even in a laboratory, we're still sorting that stuff out. So, you know, there's a huge difference in locality and terroir, and makes a big difference where it happens. And it would be different in the city, not necessarily worse either.
Wow. So it's like the yeasts are kind of like bees feeding on flowers, different flavors, right?
Yeah.
Pretty crazy.
Yeah, it's really crazy stuff. But look, I want to thank you for spending so much time with me and for doing all the work that you guys do at Heritage Radio Network. I'm genuinely impressed by a 15-year run, and you're supporting culture that's very important to me. For me, like, the entire food and beverage industry is a revelation, and I love it. And I think that the people who are in this industry are doing something incredibly important. And there's this idea I keep coming back to, the word focus, which is a Roman word that means hearth. And that was so important to the Romans that they set up the Vestal Virgins as a priestesshood to keep the fire burning, so that anybody who needed it for their own hearth at their home could go to the center of the town and bring more fire back. And you see the living embodiment of that in restaurants and bars all around the United States, I think, in ways that people don't even fully grasp. These areas where people come together to eat and to drink and to be with other people form such a fundamental human function that it's an honor to be part of the industry. And you've clearly, you know, been at this for a very, very long time. And so just to have, the opportunity to come on here and talk to you and for you to spend so much time with me is a real honor. I appreciate it.
And thank you, Reed. Thanks for joining me. Once again, I'll say Cuenta Cuentos, your brands are always my go-to when I'm at Bolzol events and other tasting events. So thank you so much for being part of that. Thanks so much to Armin Spingen, our engineer. And I'm Jimmy Carboni. I'm the host here on Beer Essentials Radio. We'll catch you next time on Heritage Radio Network. All right. Thank you.
Beer Sessions Radio is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.